Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio and WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. It is a beautiful weekend here in central Indiana, and we are taking advantage of it today. We're spending today's Eat Drink Indiana Radio episode outside, talking about and looking for wild edible plants. I'll head to Columbus, Indiana to spend some time with Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington, and we'll explore the edible landscape around his family's home. Daniel is an award-winning chef, a cookbook author, and the host of the Earth Eats podcast and public radio program on WFIU in Bloomington. So we'll have plenty to talk about as we sample some of the wild plants growing near his home and in the gardens that he's created that fill up much of the suburban yard. And then, inspired by our foraging, I also give morel hunting in Indianapolis a try. So stay with us for a foraging-focused episode of Eat Drink Indiana Radio here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Today on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are spending the day outside talking about wild edible plants and even sampling a few. Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington Restaurant is a cookbook author, a James Beard Award semifinalist, and the host of the Earth Eats podcast and public radio program on WTIU in Bloomington. He was an award-winning chef in New York City, then worked in the Caribbean, but when he came home to Indiana to open his Farm Bloomington restaurant, he went to work on his parents' yard at their suburban Columbus home. We walked around the yard recently and through a nearby wooded area to see what was growing, and to talk about all the wild plants that end up in his kitchen.
When I got back to Indiana, my parents were getting a little older. My dad was still with us, and I wanted to create something that was more sustainable for them, that also I could introduce items to the restaurant, and cut down on the mowing. And, so I put in this, what I call an edible landscape, and I've been continuing it every year, putting in new fruit trees, new different types of plants and bushes, and adding even new wild seeds and giving wild spaces over to areas that I can forage right here on the property.
It's beautiful. I think it's probably been 3 or 4 years since I've been out here, and it's just lush.
Yeah, I think, well, we're lucky with all the rain this year, but we have put a lot of energy into it, and, I've created the space to kind of adapt to that. We've even put in areas that the water can flow so there's good drainage, and then put plants in those draining areas that enjoy wet ambiance. And, so those things, we're really trying to plant things that will be perennial, that will take care of themselves, so it's not as much work for my 82-year-old mom or me.
Right. So kind of tell me what we have here in the front yard in general.
Well, across the road is a real wild space, and luckily my neighbors let me go over there and trample through that. And I find all kinds of things, from wild strawberries to right now the flowering locust trees are flowering, and I like to make a jam or jelly out of the locust flowers.
I noticed that on the highway coming down toward Columbus that the honey locusts are just blooming like mad.
And, on a warmer day and sunnier day, you'd really smell that. I mean, the perfume just flows off those trees. And so I said, there must be some way to utilize that, because I know you can use elderflowers. And so I looked up some old recipes and found a honey locust jam and made that, and have made that several years in a row now.
Wow, I would like to do that. That sounds wonderful. So we have honey locusts that are blooming now.
Right.
What else is going on?
Well, the red buds are kind of surrounding the whole yard. And when they first come out, they've got those beautiful flowers, and those are delicious. You can sprinkle those on salads. They have a little bit of tannin to them, and the tannin is the same healthy tannin that red wine has. So they are very healthy. The Native Americans ate them. And then after that, they will turn into little beans, and they'll look like little bean pods.
I know what you mean. Uh-huh. I have lots of red buds in my yard, so you can do something with that too.
So you want to pick those when they're about an inch or less big. So they're very small, and then you can just blanch them and toss them in salads, toss them in stir fries. Once they get bigger than that, they start to get fibrous, and they're not good. But those are two things you can use from that tree. And that's also another legume tree, which is like the honey locust, which also produces a pod. So, you know, we do have those two trees do have that in common. As you see, we have our evergreens, and this time of year, they shoot out those little nice, very light green, mossy green color tips.
I've been noticing those. So I noticed some this morning, and I wondered if we were going to talk about the pine tree.
Yeah, the pine trees are edible. I talked to one woman who back just post-World War II in Germany, they would gather those little pine tips and boil them and cook them down to a syrup because they didn't have any sugar. And that was one of the only sweet things that they got to eat.
It would have a little sweetness.
Yeah, right? It did have that pininess to it. But when you don't have anything else to eat, you manage to do. So that was a treat, actually. But I like to do is I like to stuff those little light green shoots into trout and then bake it. I like to cook mussels, steam mussels, and throw some of those in there. It gives a really nice piney flavor. You can put a little gin and some butter and cream in there, and you've got a wonderful mussel dish. And you can also put them in a high-proof alcohol and kind of make your own gin, because gin has that kind of piney juniper flavor, and you can make your own Hoosier Pine gin.
Okay, I'm going to try that. Yeah. I absolutely am going to try that. So what else are we going to look at?
Well, you can see through the garden area, this is where we actually plant seeds, but I'm trying to make this more perennial, so it's less to take care of. So I'm just keeping a few rows next to the old basketball fence, and those I've put in some Chinese long beans and Japanese cucumbers to climb that fence, and also some loofah sponges. And then I also put in some rhubarb and asparagus in there. But you can see these yellow flowers, which you see all along the highway and in fields. There are whole fields full of this.
I've been noticing that lately.
Yeah, this is wintercress. So it's a member of the watercress family. And you can see the leaves actually look like watercress. And when you eat those, they're very floral. And so you can eat those leaves, put them in salads, and put them on sandwiches, serve them with a nice roast beef. So that's a wild thing. And we let a few of those go. So every year we have a few of them, and they just kind of, you know, move around the garden, and, you know, we find them wherever we find them. over here we have our wild Jerusalem artichokes, and that's a whole patch. You can see these taller green plants. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which are, you know, right now they're about a foot and a half tall. But they'll get 6 to 8 feet tall.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's one of these things that, you know, we'll get to enjoy them all summer long, a nice green kind of area. It shades the garden a little bit, keeps the direct sun off some of the plants. And then in the fall, we'll cut them back. And then we can harvest those Jerusalem artichokes all winter long. They actually, as long as you can dig the ground, you can harvest the artichokes. So that's one of those nice things to have in your yard. They do grow all along the side of the highway as well. You'll see them. They look kind of like sunflowers, but they're multi-headed.
Exactly. I know just what you're talking about now.
Yeah. So that's a good thing. You can, when you see those flowers blooming on the highway, you know, you can go mark them, or in a state park or something, you can mark them, and then you can go back and dig them later. So, you know, the plants will all die back, but those roots will still be under the ground. So I like to take along, you know, a couple spikes with me if I want to mark something that I want to come back and find later. That's always a good thing to do. One thing that you always want to do is, of course, ask permission if you're going to go foraging on someone else's property, and also make sure that they don't treat their lawn with chemicals. Also, you want to stay about 10 to 15 feet at least away from a country road, and even further away from a heavily trafficked highway.
From the roadside, right?
Right, because there's those de-icing chemicals they put on all winter, mm-hmm. and then the exhaust and the heavy metals that come from the exhaust. So you want to just stay away from those. But other than that, you know, that's one of the reasons we don't treat our yard and we don't use chemicals here, is because we like to eat everything that we can, you know. And instead of spraying the dandelions, we get our revenge by eating them. So.
We've been talking with Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington Restaurant. We'll be back with more from Daniel about foraging wild edibles here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Katzenberger, and we are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio today talking with Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington. I headed to Columbus this past week to spend a morning foraging with the chef who has been creating an edible landscape at his mother's suburban Columbus home. We walked around the yard and a nearby wooded area and found an abundance of edible plants, ones that would be easy to find in just about any central Indiana yard.
Just come up from seeds that were left the year before. This is all cilantro, and none of this was planted. These are marigold plants, and I use those flowers in the restaurant. They flower very late, so it's one of our last mm-hmm. flowers that we get to use in the fall. Over here across the road, we have a plant that is called plantain, and I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I see it in my yard. Yeah. It's right. It just looks like a weed, right?
They also call it sow's lettuce.
Yeah, it is.
Right here.
Right, yeah.
So this is actually a very interesting herb and medicinal plant. And they use it a lot because it has these spines in the leaf. You know, so there's six or eight kind of spines. And this, you know, again, I would harvest this a little further away from the side of the road, but this goes all the way up into here. And this you can saute and cook like greens. Uh-huh. It's very, very nutritious, and you can go online and look up all the health benefits to it. But I've been using this more and more. It's kind of a tough green when you just try to eat it raw, but after you cook it, it comes very tender, and you can cook it down with other greens like dandelions, which we have here. So, dandelion comes from the word dent de lion, which means tooth of the lion, and you can see are used. So, you want to usually pick these in the spring. They're best because they're as soon as the sun hits them for long days, they get tough and bitter. Mm-hmm. But you can still find them in the shade and under trees and things all summer long and eat them as greens.
So now we're just right here by a road, right under some trees. We're not in the midst of the woods or anything.
No. A lot of these things grow right next door to us, and we think of them as weeds. Or things that are obnoxious, and they're actually, you know, get your revenge back by going out there and eating them yourself. The roots of the dandelion's a member of the chicory family, which you probably have heard of chicory coffee and other things that are members of chicory are Belgian endive and curly endive and radicchio. And
oh, sure, all the same family, right?
Those are all the same family. So dandelions are a member of that. And the chicory coffee is actually made from the root of chicory plants. So you can dig up these roots, and they'll be, you know, 6 or 8 inches long. Wash them really well, slice them up, dry them, then toast them, and then there you can make a coffee substitute with them. But what I do at the restaurant is I make a crème anglaise, so it's like a coffee English custard cream. Mm-hmm. So you just cook those down in the milk and sweeten it and then thicken it with eggs, and you have a dandelion dessert.
Oh, very
which
nice.
Is really good. And the cream kind of tames that bitterness, just like you put cream in your coffee.
Sure. So what else are you seeing right here? Because honestly, we're just looking, you know, in an area that looks like it hasn't been mowed for a while. Just, you know, some lots of clover and dandelions. What else?
Okay, well, these are wild onions, and they look more like chives. They're very thin, prime for using. The Native Americans used these a lot. And you would use in the spring when they're very, very tender, you can use this whole top just like you would use chives. And you can even cut them into about 2-inch segments and, you know, put them with shredded potatoes and make like latkes with them, which are very, very nice. And then you can use the bulbs just like you would use garlic. And then these, you can cut these stems up, and I'll show you later inside where I've done a flavored vinegar with them. So you clean these really well, put them in a bottle, mix some white vinegar, a little bit of sugar, a little bit of salt, and some peppercorns, and you pour that over your wild onions, and you've got a really nice vinegar that you can use all year round.
Very cool.
What else do we have just right here? Well, across the street, well, we've got right here, there's a wild strawberry plant, and you can see how it looks a lot like the strawberry.
All right, these are the little ones we might see, tiny little ones in our yard, right?
Yep. Yep, so feuilles de bois, they'd call them, or wood strawberries in French. And you can see that's forming a little strawberry right there.
Sure.
So that's really kind of a fun thing. And then I'm sure that there's some... So up here we have those honey locusts, and you'll see those trees across the road there. I also go hunting for chanterelles up in that woods.
Do you have luck with that?
Yeah, chanterelles, pretty much every year we get a good crop. We also have over here some wild blackberries. This is a blackberry bramble.
Oh, and they're starting to come on. They're
going to bloom. Starting to bloom there. And we also have right a cure... antioxidant cure.
I've been seeing a lot more of that lately.
Yeah, yeah. And then you can see these have some little tiny spines on the bottom of the leaf,
right.
And that's why they call them stinging nettles. If you slap these or touch them, you'll get a rash. And we used to, at Boy Scout camp, we used to take these around, run after each other and smack people with them. And they'd have a leaf tattoo for a few weeks. All right, not really that long, a few hours. So we've got those are stinging nettles. You can also puree those up, cook them, saute them, cook them like greens. Very, very nutritious. And again, it's free food. They come up the same place every year. And I think that you'll really enjoy them. You can see those blackberries, brambles are.
Oh, you have a nice blackberry area, don't you?
Yeah, and then this is wild garlic mustard. And so you can taste that. That has kind of a strong taste, almost like broccoli rabe or rapini.
Yeah, it does.
It's a member of the same family as broccoli. And it was brought over here. It's an invasive plant. So they do mustard pulls and things like that in the state park,
mm-hmm.
Just to kind of eradicate that out of the park. So you're doing the world a favor by eating this. And... You can just pull these. When you go out and harvest them, you want to pull them up by the roots so that they don't come back the next year. And you want to get them before you can see here they've got seed pods on them.
Right.
And they say that each plant can produce, I think, 10,000 seeds, and the seeds can last in the earth for up to 10 years before they...
This is why they've overtaken things.
Right, right. And these are brought in, again, they were brought in as a pot herb or something to eat by early Americans... early Europeans, and then it's just taken over the whole country.
I'm seeing the little flowers. Oh, of course. There they are, the honey locusts,
yep.
Right over our
yep.
head.
And they smell so good, especially when the sun heats them up. You can just smell these from all around the lake. You can smell them. Other things that we have around this area are wild grapes.
Yeah, can you do anything with those?
Yeah, the grape leaves... I like to make dolmas out of.
Oh, absolutely. Wouldn't that be cool? So you have your wild grape leaves for that. So what are you looking for?
Well, I know that there is a grape vine that goes up in this tree, but I don't see it.
Hasn't
greened out yet. But we do have some grape leaves on the other side of the property that I can show you. Let's see if there's anything else over here. It's edible.
Oh, there's all the little green shoots that you were talking about on the pine trees. Oh, my goodness. Once you start looking for them, they're everywhere.
These are violets. Not this. These are violets right here. They've got a heart-shaped leaf. And earlier on when the flowers are blooming, we've got one flower right here.
Mm-hmm.
You can eat those. They're great on salads, other greens. And a lot of people... when you're introducing some of these wild herbs, put them with things they already like, some romaine lettuce and some, iceberg or bib lettuce, and then just add a few of these wild greens, and you'll kind of wean them off those industrially produced plants and eating more of these wild greens. This right here is called poke.
Oh, now see, I get that in my yard too.
Okay, and poke comes back every year, and you can see it's about 12 inches long. It's you want to eat it when it's this size. You don't really want to eat it much bigger than this.
Because it will grow taller than you, probably.
It will, and it also becomes poisonous.
Right, with those berries. We can't eat those berries.
So you want to eat it when it's small, and you blanch it twice and change the water, and then it tastes a lot like asparagus. And you can use it.
Is the leaves or the stalk?
Both. I like the stalk the best.
Uh-huh.
It really does have that asparagus kind of flavor to it. So I'm going to go ahead and pick a few of these. And here we got some wild grape leaves.
Nice.
So what I do with these is I pick them off, and you want them still to be kind of light colored. So these haven't been hit by a whole lot of sun. And, you know, usually pick the larger ones. And then what I do is I place them in a jar. After I wash them, place them in a jar, and then pour a hot vinegar mixture over them and pickle them. And then you can use them as stuffed dolmas, you know, stuff them with rice. Or you can even do kind of like you would a cabbage roll with them.
Sure.
You know, with some meats, and then you put them in a tomato sauce, roll them up, and they're really, really nice that way. And it's fun to use these things that you grow yourself or that you just find yourself.
We've been foraging for wild edible plants with Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington. We'll be back with more on foraging here on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio talking about wild edible plants with Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington Restaurant. Daniel is a cookbook author and the host of Earth Eats, a podcast and public radio show on WTIU in Bloomington. Since moving back to Indiana, he has worked to create an edible landscape at his mother's suburban Columbus home. And as we walked around outside the house, he pointed out all the wild plants that can easily be encouraged to grow in a central Indiana backyard.
These are bunches of greens that are kind of spiky, and they are from wild garlic bulbs. Soup with them, but I use them in marinades and broths and stocks, and you can use pretty much the whole thing. And you want to use these in the spring while they're still young. They will form garlic bulbs on the bottom, but they tend to be very small. If you do separate these out, you can propagate larger bulbs of garlic. But these are really a nice spring product. You could, you know, use them any way that you would garlic, but use the whole thing. So in sautés and marinades. We're getting over here to these nice pine tips.
They are beautiful green.
Right, a very nice light green. And you want to capture them when they are this size and color. Americans are really afraid of bitter.
And these have that's true. People tend to be, right.
Yeah, and these have quite a bit of bitterness. Some of them do have more sweetness to them. We'll come around over here to the other side of the house.
Again, we're just like walking around your house.
Yeah.
You're not out in the middle of the woods anywhere.
It's kind of, we've gathered these things from the wild, brought them in, and propagated them in the yard so we can use them. This is wild ginger.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Which isn't really a member of the ginger family, but it has a gingerish flavor to the root. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we got wild and brought in, and now it's kind of made itself a home here. You can see we put all of our plants out for the summer. So this is our bay laurel bushes right here. Mm-hmm. Which we move in into the wintertime. Some more pulque coming up here. And dandelions are never hard to find. Another thing that I like to pick, and it's actually one of my favorite wild edibles, is greenbrier. Do you know what greenbrier is?
I don't. Tell me.
It's a woodland thorn, and when you walk through the woods and you get grabbed by those tall, long, green briars,
right,
those
okay,
are green
right.
briars.
Okay.
This time of year, when they start to sprout out, they have these little curly tips, and they are delicious. They really are good.
All right.
And over here, we have some wild elderflowers.
These have
not flowered yet. You can see the little flower heads coming
sure.
up. And these are wild, and they will be very perfumey. And that's what Saint-Germain is made out of,
the liqueur.
You can also take those flowers and when they're opened up, it almost looks like a piece of lace. And you can deep fry those in a tempura and then with some powdered sugar and make a really nice dessert.
It sounds garnish. Like a beautiful dessert.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can kind of see these have kind of just self-propagated. Now they're moving over here across the road, across the path. We have, this is all garlic mustard greens. So here are all these little white flower tips of the wild garlic mustard. Now this is kind of our little woodland area.
So it's very going to be very shady, right?
Yeah. And so this is has a different type of plant growing on it, but these elderberries have moved down here too. They weren't here last year, so they're starting to move around. These are our hazelnut trees.
Oh my goodness, now you've planted some of these, right?
Yeah, and these are all inoculated with black truffle sporum.
Oh my goodness, now tell me about that.
So the these we've gotten from Oregon, and I went out to the truffle festival out there, and my brother's done a lot of research, and so we have about 10 trees here at the lake, and then we have more down on the farm, and he has about 10 in Texas. And so we're seeing if we can do it. And he actually has bought a truffle dog and is training it. So,
oh my gosh, so you are going to have truffles here one of these days.
So we're hoping. Usually it takes 8 to 10 years.
So how long have they been here?
They've been here about 4.
All right, we know when to come back.
Yeah. Now this is that winter cress that we were talking about before. And it has a floral flavor.
Very floral.
And again, when you mix that with other ingredients, you know, it becomes more palatable. I always say that, you know, if you're making some of these greens and stuff, the dandelions and wild garlic mustard greens, if you put a little bit of bacon or bacon fat, if you put a touch of honey, something sweet, so you got smoky and sweet, and then something acid, some citrus or some vinegar, it becomes very, very palatable. And back in the old days, they would call that pot liquor. That would be the...
Of course, from the pan.
Yeah, from the pan, the drainage from the greens, and then they'd even serve little cruets of vinegar on the table, and you could put your own butter and vinegar on your greens. So that's a very old-timey Southern Indiana thing.
That's so what? What
that's
is
that's a jade plant?
And what is that?
This is our composting area. So we have 3 stages of compost, and the jade plant's growing right in there. And it's not actually an edible, but something good for the kitchen. You can squeeze it onto burns.
Like aloe,
and it will help mosquito bites and burns and things like that. So jade plant is nice to find, and it's one of those things that's pretty much everywhere. We get really soggy down here.
But the rain has been good, right?
Yes. So over here is another edible. This is something that is from Japan.
Oh my goodness, this is huge.
And I'm going to have to call my friend Mihoko and find out again how to use it. She gave me the starts. But it's something that grows wild in Japan. I just had like one of them 2 or 3 years ago.
Well, it's looking great now.
Yeah, now it's really kind of... I guess you eat the stalks. It almost looks like a rhubarb stalk, except for they're about 2.5 feet long. And then the leaves, you can wrap things up in them and steam them, like, you know, rice cakes or fish or that kind of thing, and use the leaves for kind of the cooking container, cooking vessel. Now we're down here by the lake, and... we don't eat a lot of stuff out of the lake. Right here, we don't have any cattails. That's one of the things that I love to forage.
Yes, I'm starting to see them now.
Yeah, and the cattails, they call them the supermarket of the marsh. And so the roots are edible, and you can dry them and make a kind of a flour out of them. The stalks, when they're young, you can kind of pull them up and eat those when they're very, very light and tendered color, white colored and tender, and they're almost like a cucumber flavor. And then right around the end of June, the stalks will produce pollen. And the pollen is awesome. That's one of my favorite things.
Why? Tell me why.
Well, it's just I love to make cattail pollen muffins. It's a recipe that's in my cookbook. It's something that we always did as kids. It's kind of like pioneer days. And, you know, my mom and we'd go out. And so it has some nostalgic, you know, references to it. So I'm sure that's part of the reason I like it. The cat flower self-pollinates. So the bottom of the cattail stalk is where you have those nice brown tubular cattails. And then above it is a little spike that has the pollen. So the pollen falls right down on the female part of the plant. So what you do is you get, when that pollen's still kind of soft and greenish yellow, you pull that off and you can gather as much as you want and freeze it. And then you add that to muffins and things. And it's just, it adds this kind of sweet kind of flavor that it's hard to describe. It is a pollen flavor, but there's a sweetness to it, tastes nutritional. I don't know. So you can see here, this was some wild asparagus that I picked earlier.
Oh, sure. It's just popped up there in the midst of some vines.
Right. And there's some more wild onions up through here. And then we've got black walnut trees above us, which those are probably 80 years old. So they've been here way before we were. And we've got another blackberry bramble through there. And see those big leafy leek-looking things? That's elephant garlic that's just kind of self-planted there from an animal that moved it from somewhere else.
There's so much stuff here just in your suburban yard.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the less poisoning you do to your landscape, the more this stuff will come up. So, you know, the first answer to everything isn't, you know, kind of the American medical way of doing things is just, you know, put a Band-Aid on it and get rid of it. You know, you need to go back to the roots of everything and see what you can use, what could be beneficial. You know, just because someone else's yard is perfectly green, doesn't have dandelions, doesn't mean that you have to do the same thing. And, you know, everyone knows about the honeybees and how much trouble they're having. And one of their favorite foods is dandelions, and we're taking all those away from them. So, you know, don't be ashamed of having a few dandelions in your yard.
We're talking with chef and cookbook author Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington. Daniel hosts the Earth Eats podcast and public radio show on WTIU in Bloomington. Stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio for more on foraging and cooking here on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio talking about using wild edible plants with chef and cookbook author Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington. We've walked around his suburban Columbus yard, explored a nearby wooded area, and sampled a variety of wild foods along the way today. But we also talked about cultivating the habits needed to make use of some of the wild plants, and Daniel offers some advice for incorporating wild ingredients.
So this is, like I said, I'm trying to make this a more perennial. Mm-hmm. So as mom gets older, there won't be as much gardening. It'll be more just berry picking and things like that.
Now, when you see some of these things, how does your inspiration work, you know, for a dish? When you're using some of these wild things, do you think flavors? Do you have the dish first and then look for the ingredients?
Well, I think that it's really what is available at that time, because a lot of these things are just available for a short period of time. There's always something available, but it's not always available for the whole season. So you're really kind of using the season to tell you what to do. And so, you know, if I do find a bunch of the poke, you know, then I'll do a dish like that. And what I'll usually try to do is to make it as acceptable to the mass majority of the folks. So, you know, if you're using something wild, you know, add a hollandaise. Everybody knows what hollandaise is. Everyone loves hollandaise. Do that. Or, you know, do something, you know, people are crazy about garlic. So a lot of times I'll do garlic. People are crazy about bacon. So you can start adding some of those other ingredients that you know are sellers. And, you know, and then the other thing I do with the wild greens is I use them as accents. So if I have a scallop dish, people love seared scallops, instead of putting spinach with it, put lamb's quarter with it. You know, so you're taking dishes that you can do other times of the year, but you're utilizing the local wild foraged products, you know, with things that are already your best seller. So you do a mac and cheese, but you can add wild garlic to it, you know. So you're using these comfort foods, things that people can relate to, but then you're adding that little different touch to it that makes it, you know, more eco-friendly, more, you know, social friendly, and gives people something new to think about.
I think this is probably a mindset. Is this something that you've cultivated, no pun intended, over the years, you know, this sort of working with what's here and now?
Well, I think that it did come from, you know, a couple generations. My great-grandmother Wolf, my grandma and grandpa Kolb, then my mother and father, who were kind of like, you know, hippies during the 70s, but without the drugs. So, you know, we made our own soap. We,
back
you know,
to
picked
nature
our own
kind
berries.
Of thing, right?
Yeah, we kind of did all that kind of stuff. And, you know, my grandpa would go out and he would know where, you know, the pawpaw trees were. You know, he used to, when he would walk to school, you know, they would stop and they would eat pawpaws till they got sick because they didn't have sugar and treats and Hershey bars and all that kind of stuff. And there weren't drive-through restaurants. So, you know, the closest to a drive-through was to find a mulberry tree or a pawpaw tree and eat until you got sick. And, you know, then my parents started making wine with different ingredients, different berries, different wild things. You know, so it was something that wasn't just from my parents, but it was from, you know, my grandparents and my great-grandparents. Something about being, you know, in southern Indiana for, you know, close to 200 years that it kind of gets into your blood.
This is a part of you. You just grew up with this.
Yeah, yeah. Something that I have continued, but I mean, most of the stuff that we've spoken about today, I did learn from my mother or from another friend, Gretchen Sigmund, or, you know, from my grandparents.
But it's something that the people could do themselves, you know, if they start looking, I think.
Yeah, I would say, you know, make sure you buy a good guide and, you know, eat things in small quantities to see how you react to them, how you like them, how they react to you. And, but, you know, most of the things that we've found today are very recognizable. You're not going to have, you know, any identification problems with them. You know, so, but take that good guidebook along with you and also read the recommendations on how to cook them, because a lot of times you may not like something when it's raw, but if you prepare it the way that it's been, you know, a recipe is written for, then you may end up liking it.
Any advice for someone who is trying to forage just a little bit and sort of give it a try?
Well, I think that the main thing is to get out there and have fun. A lot of us, you know, don't have enough movement in our life. What we do is we tend to, you know, sit in front of a computer screen or sit in front of a TV screen or, you know, like we were talking about earlier, you know, pick up 30% of our meals are eaten out these days. And it may even be more than that. I think I read one statistic that people are actually buying more prepared food than they're preparing themselves. Like it's broken the 50% mark. So going out there, moving, you know, we all have our issues. I'm a little bit overweight, but getting out there and sweating a little bit, moving, bending over, keeping those joints active, it's a good thing. And, you know, bring someone along with you. You know, maybe develop a club, get other people active, go out and do a garlic mustard pull at a state park. You'll be doing yourself a favor and the state park. So, you know, go out fishing, you know, eat some local bluegill, some local bass. All those kind of things are delicious. And then when you incorporate them with the other wild edibles that are just right outside your doorstep, I think that not only will you have a more varied palate, but you'll have a more flavorful palate. And it's one of the most important things is to remember you want that whole rainbow spectrum of foods. So, you know, it seems like we get caught in eating pretty much the same basic things all the time. So we're eating, you know, chicken, pork, beef,
potatoes,
you know, romaine lettuce, And we just kind of get stuck in these tracks because they're easy, they're economical. We know how
they're
to cook it.
Familiar.
Our families all like them. But when you introduce a more of a rainbow spectrum, you'll get more nutrition, you'll get more antioxidants, you'll most likely live a healthier and longer life.
We've been talking with Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington Restaurant about wild plants, so we next headed into the kitchen to add some of our harvest into a rich broth that had already simmered for hours.
All right, so what we've done is that we've made a bone broth, and bone broths are really big this, you know, this year. Basically, it's just beef stock using good bones like leg bones and oxtails and things like that. It gives you a really nice protein broth, very low in fat, and lots of flavor. One of the keys to making a good bone broth is to really brown the bones either in the oven or in your pan before you add the liquid. And then let it cool after you've strained the meat out. Let it cool, and you can just pull all the fat off the top if you've put it in the refrigerator overnight. And then you get a very lean broth, and it's a deep in flavor. And what we did today is we just finished it with the lamb's quarter, or wild spinach, and just chopped it up really roughly and added it to the broth, brought it back to one boil, and there you go. And you'll see that it has a really nice texture. It adds an earthiness to it and lots of good fiber.
We've been talking with Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington. You can find more information at farmbloomington.com or check out his Earth Eats podcast and public radio show at indianapublicmedia.org/earth-eats. The Earth Eats program and podcast, hosted by Annie Corrigan and Chef Daniel Orr, now has a book out as well. Earth Eats, Real Food, Green Living features tips, tricks, and advice on growing, preparing, and shopping for local seasonal ingredients. It also includes profiles of individuals working in the local food movement in central Indiana, and it features more than 200 recipes as well. More information at eartheats.org or look for Earth Eats on Facebook. You can find more information on the chef at chefdanielorr.com. I spent a morning this past week talking about wild edible plants with chef, cookbook author, and WFIU Earth Eats host Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington Restaurant. We tromped around his family's suburban Columbus home and found all sorts of edible plants, some growing wild in wooded areas, and some that he's encouraged to grow in various gardens and beds in the yard. So that got me thinking about my own yard, where there is an abundance of dandelion greens just waiting for me to harvest them, and also plenty of seed pods on redbud trees, and possibly some poke plants too. But I also started thinking about morel mushrooms, those tasty but elusive gems that are so good but so hard to find. Well, they're hard for me to find anyway. Take along an expert and you might have better luck. Now, I certainly did when I went morel hunting with Britt Bunyard, editor of Fungi magazine. He was home visiting in Indiana some years ago, and we met at a state park to talk morels and see what we could find. Well, we found plenty that day, and it was just this time of year, too. So, inspired by my morning spent foraging with Chef Orr, and with the memory of a successful mushroom hunt in mind, I decided to set out on my own this past week and see what I could find. So it is a beautiful day here in Indianapolis. It's in the mid-70s. It rained last night, and now the sun is out. And I'm thinking that I just might be able to go out and find some morel mushrooms. Some people are saying it might be just a little bit late. I don't know. I thought I would go out today. The weather seems right. The conditions seem right. So I thought I would head out to a local state park. In this case, I'm headed to Fort Harrison State Park. And I thought I'd see if I can find a few morels. So Fort Harrison State Park is about, a 10 or 15 minute drive from my house. And I live in the South Broad Ripple area, Meridian Kessler. So it really isn't very far away to get to one of the state's nicest state parks. And right here in the middle of the city. So that's why I like it. And also, it's a handy place to come to forage a little bit. So it's perfectly legal to look for morel mushrooms in state parks. In fact, Brown County State Park has a morel hunting event every year. So they take people around on tours and show them the morel hunting ropes, so to speak. But if you want to go out on your own in a state park right here in central Indiana, Fort Harrison isn't a bad place to try. Lots of trails, easy trails. It's not difficult hiking at all. And you can get off the trails to look for the mushrooms. So that's what I'm going to try to do today here at Fort Harrison State Park. Now, if you haven't been to the state park, it's the former Fort Benjamin Harrison Army Base. And you go right out East 56th Street until you hit Post Road. Post Road, right? The Army Base, the Army Post. So then you turn onto Post Road toward the State Park. You'll go right past the State Park Inn, which is a very nice place to stay for a little weekend getaway. And then you turn into the State Park itself. And it is a lovely state park, like I said, right in the middle of the city. And it has an award-winning golf course, if you happen to be into that sort of thing. So as you come in, we're driving right past the golf course right now. And since it is a beautiful day in Indianapolis, people are out golfing in the middle of the afternoon on a weekday. So we'll head to the main gate, pay our fee to get it in, and then see what we can find. Hello. Just a car.
Today?
Uh-huh, just
it's
today.
$7. Uh-huh. I'll be right back.
Thank you.
Need a map?
Yes, I do. Thank you. So once you come in through the gate, it's a lovely state park. Very green. Again, it doesn't feel like you're in the middle of the city, which is a very nice amenity here in the middle of Indianapolis. I'm trying to think about where might be a good place. Now, I've come here to look for morel mushrooms before, and I've had just a little bit of luck. Not too much, not nearly as much as I would like. But I'm kind of keeping an eye out for, you know, dead standing trees that might indicate that it might be a good place for morels. Some undergrowth, but not too much. You want to be able to see down into the floor of the woods. So I'm just going to try to find a nice place near some trails and then see what we can see. So I'm here at the Lawrence Creek Trailhead parking area at Fort Harrison State Park, and I'm going to take a try at trying to find some morels. So I'm very near to the trail, so I'm just going to head out and see what I can find. Well, I'm seeing plenty of woodier mushrooms here. Maybe that bodes well for morels. So again, I'm seeing lots of other mushrooms, ones I am not familiar with, and if you're not familiar with mushrooms, it's better just to leave them alone. But morels are distinctive enough that I feel comfortable looking for those. So again, I'm seeing lots of other sorts of fungus, but I haven't spotted any morels yet, although I have noticed that the May apples are up about, maybe a foot tall. That's a plant that tends to come up around the same time as morels already. But again, it's always just, just the luck of the draw, whether you happen to hit a day where you can spot them or not. And oftentimes, once you see one, you'll start to see more. It's like your eyes get accustomed to what to look for. So like right now I'm looking at the forest floor and it's pretty much covered with leaves, pretty brown still, which makes the morels harder to find if indeed there are any close by. So wouldn't a morel app be a very cool thing to have on your phone so that you could then, you know, look around and say, oh, there are some close by. But anyway, I'm still looking and still hopeful. Aha, so I finally have found the end of a morel mushroom, and from the looks of it, it was a very big one. So hopefully there are some more around in this area. Clearly someone has been here before me, and fairly recently. and gotten this magnificent one, which was, it was clearly a big morel mushroom. So I'm going to look around this area and see if I can find some more. Well, although I didn't find any morels, well, let me rephrase that. I found one morel whose top had already been taken off. But even though I didn't find any morels in abundance this time, I did see lots of other fungi, but I am not qualified to know if those were edible or not, so I took pictures and let them stay. It was nice to get out in the woods, just to get out and look for something, look at something that wasn't a computer or phone screen, and to enjoy the scenery and the sounds right here in the middle of the city. Well, even though my morel hunting excursion didn't yield any mushrooms this time, I think I will be heading out again soon. If you're interested in learning more about mushrooms in central Indiana, check out an upcoming class presented by the Hoosier Mushroom Society and Purdue Extension. A wild mushroom certification course will be offered this summer in Indianapolis. Registration for the class is open now, and you can find more information at hoosiermushrooms.org. Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. We've been enjoying an outdoor foraging-focused show this week, exploring the central Indiana landscape for wild edible plants. Thank you so much for joining us on our outdoor exploration this week, and thanks also to our guest and foraging guide, chef, cookbook author, and WFIU's Earth Eats host, Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio. Eat Drink Indy Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie.